Welcome to the podcast of the Geological Society. In this episode, Martin Blunt, head of the Department of Earth Science and Engineering at Imperial College London, explains the role of carbon capture and storage in the fight to reduce the UK's carbon emissions. First, the new geological map of the Arctic is the most complex map ever produced in the 168-year history of the Geological Survey of Canada. Ted Neal talks to Mark St. Onge, Senior Research Scientist at Natural Resources Canada, with the help of a rather unusual prop.
It must have been quite a feat trying to coordinate the geologists of seven nations, particularly with a slightly touchy political difficulty going on in the background. Somehow I think only the Canadians could have achieved this.
I would have said the same thing, actually. I think we were well positioned to do that. You were dealing with a group of scientists who were interested in putting the pieces of the puzzle back together. So that was the driving motivator for most people. Given that amicable setting, if there was any friction, it might have been between the Americans and the Russians. Not so much in terms of sovereignty issues, because you'll notice on the new geological map of the Arctic, we left off the political boundaries for that very reason, because we didn't want to get into that debate. But there's more friction in terms of what constitutes a geological map. Had it been left to the two extremes, I'm not sure where we would have ended up.
It's a vast area. I don't have a globe, but I do have a prop here which we can use. This is an umbrella for the purposes of the microphone. Which does have an automatic release. It's a little urgent. Wait a minute. Oh, find yourself. There we are. Now, I've opened the umbrella, and we have... We can look at the Arctic Ocean. The spike of the umbrella is pretending to be the North Pole and is sticking out of the top. Now, the Lomonosov Ridge, this topographic high...
This ridge here.
Ah, yes, it stretches from sort of Novosibirsk...
Beneath the North Pole
over to the Lincoln Sea there.
That's right, and northern Ellesmere Island and northwestern Greenland.
This is a piece of continental crust?
That's right.
Now, this ridge, of course, hit the newspapers recently when the Russians planted a flag on it.
That's right, right here.
Right there, yes, where the spike of the umbrella comes out from the middle there. So this is a particularly sensitive subject, seven nations collaborating in a map. We know that quite a lot of these nations are looking to their mineral rights, and if I understand anything about the Law of the Sea treaty, whether the rock underneath is continental or not has great bearing upon who might be said to own the mineral rights to it. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Thereby the interest by several nations in the Lomonosov Ridge, seeing it as a natural extension of one continental shelf or another continental shelf. What the new geological map of the Arctic would seem to suggest is that, if anything, the Lomonosov Ridge is part and parcel of the North American plate and rifted off the Barents Sea, Kara Sea, Continental Platform 61 million years ago to sit where we now see it under the North Pole. But everyone has to meet the deadline of presenting their case 10 years after having signed on to the UN Convention for the Law of the Sea, everyone having done that, bar the Americans.
Right, I see. You talked a lot about the indigenous peoples whose land this is, of course, after all. What sort of involvement have they had in the whole process of making this incredible new map?
We at the Geological Survey, having been around for 168 years, well, not myself specifically, but in some ways we still do what Sir William Logan was doing 168 years ago, but in other ways we've definitely progressed. And one way we've progressed is to involve the First Nation people in the work we do. This means more than just employing people to be polar bear guards or to work in the kitchen, but to actually come out on the land, which is their land, traverse with us, learn from us how we take modern geological observations. As much as possible, we try and do this with young Inuit, kids who are still in high school, in the hopes that it might interest some of them to pursue their education, eventually go to university, and then come back as Inuit geologists. Because really, ultimately, that's what one would want. They need geologists as much as they need lawyers or doctors that come from where they live.
How do you find the First Nation people actually regard this change that's overtaking their environment now, with so much more real estate becoming available, so many more seaways becoming navigable throughout the year and so on? I mean, do they see this as a threat or an opportunity?
Both, I would say. Yeah. They want input from the start to the end. So they see it as an opportunity, but they see it also as a requirement for them to adapt. But they will tell you that they've done this before. The Inuit are but the last and fourth group of Arctic dwellers in North America. They were preceded by three previous cultures, one the Thule, the Dorset, and the Eskimo, or Paleo-Eskimo. And the change from one culture to the other could always be attributed to a change in the climate. So they've adapted before, and they'll adapt again. So they're willing to do that. I think the work we do in the North in support of this map, the fieldwork, per se, is their entry point. And if they participate in that, then anything that follows, they'll be there as well.
Well, when the Geological Society of London was set up way back in 1807, one of the things that is written in the founding document is something about adopting one nomenclature. And, well, that's certainly something that you've been doing over the last few years. Mark St. Orange, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Ted Neild was talking to Mark St. Orange, co-leader of the International Compilation Project that will release a new geological map of the Arctic in 2010. Carbon capture and storage has been much talked about as a potential tool to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But earlier this month, the Daily Telegraph published a piece claiming that it can't be done, citing research at Imperial College. Martin Blunt spoke to Sarah Day following his Shell London lecture to set the record straight.
I think there are three types of problem. The first one is simply miscommunication, honest miscommunication, where the media may exaggerate or may make more exciting a finding that is rather more nuanced from a scientific perspective. That's fine, that happens all the time. The second is where the media, for balance, actually gives undue prominence to a few scientific mavericks. And hitherto, that had been the complaint about the way in which issues associated with climate change have been presented in the media. We're now seeing a third type, which is much more concerning, which is where comments are taken out of context and any even cursory look that the primary material would indicate that it is being taken out of context and used to support essentially a political agenda. That really is quite alarming for scientists because it's a misrepresentation of what we're doing and what we're trying to say. And I think the scientific method and scientists as a profession, particularly those working in areas that have a lot of public concern associated with them, feel themselves under quite a lot of stress as a result. Scientists are genuinely trying to understand how the Earth works and what's going to happen. They are human beings, just like any other human being. They can make mistakes and they can be quite prejudiced. But the overall thrust of the scientific enterprise is really towards a genuine understanding of the Earth and what is likely to happen and what we can do about it. And that should be appreciated and respected.
And what was it that was misreported in the Telegraph about the work at Imperial?
It was a claim that we had supported a conclusion of a paper that has suggested that carbon capture and storage was impossible because the pressures would be so high as to fracture the rock. It was indeed quite the opposite of what our studies have shown, that CCS at the large scale is challenging but can be done, and that with careful design, careful injection design, which is what I work in, you can indeed inject large amounts of CO2 still safely.
People talk about it as a sort of reverse of the oil industry, just putting it back where we've taken it out before. Is it as simple as that?
It's almost as simple as that. So what you do is you take fossil fuels from out of the ground, oil, gas and coal. Carbon capture and storage is where you collect the CO2 that's produced from burning these fossil fuels at large point sources, so power stations, refineries, So the CO2 that's produced, you collect and you inject it back deep underground. And indeed, you can put the CO2 back from the oil and gas fields from which the hydrocarbon came originally, or you can store it in saline aquifers deep underground as well. We have the components of the technology already. I think we are ready to begin pilot plants now. BP had a scheme to sequester CO2 in the North Sea that would have been up and running last year had the government decided to support it. So we can do that. We need to do pilot plants. You need to see that they work. You need to iron out the problems. That's going to take 10 years before you can then have another round, much more extensive deployment of the technology, and possibly a third round before you do it worldwide. Now we're talking about almost 30 years, so we need to start now, because really by 2030, CCS needs to be making a serious contribution to reducing atmospheric emissions of CO2.
Do you think that's likely to happen then? Are we sort of on the right track?
We are certainly not on the right track. It's a growing concern among people working in this broad area that we are heading towards a simply burn fossil fuels unabated, with renewables really only taking over once fossil fuels become much more expensive, by which time our CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere are probably very, very high. That's the real worry. That's the course on which we're heading at the moment. And there does appear to be a lack of political imagination and public will to move us onto a different track. That's very alarming.
Do you have any idea of the sort of way we could move forward with how we could make that situation better? Is it relying on the media or public will?
It's difficult to know exactly what policy, from an engineering perspective, we should just be doing it, trying it, see if it works. From a policy perspective, both the UK and Europe have announced the intention to support carbon capture and storage plants. And the encouragement would be to do that quickly and with a certain amount of panache and imagination, so get it to happen. In the longer term, you want some sort of financial mechanism by which we generate low carbon electricity and we see whichever method that is the best works. Carbon capture and storage is one of a number of options. It's not on its own sufficient.
This issue about looking at the facts yourself and drawing your own conclusions rather than just misinterpreting someone else's, is this something anybody can do? Is all this data freely available?
Yes, but I wish it was something that people did more of. One of the beauties of the internet is there's an awful lot of material that is publicly available. Data on population, data on CO2 concentrations, data on how much oil we produce and consume. And people, I think, should feel free to look at that. Most people seem to think they can use the internet to let everyone else know what they think, so post some comment. But I view the internet as giving you the opportunity to learn and analyse. You're not forced to look at someone else's opinion. You can make it yourself. And that's really very important, and it's very democratising, and it's very intellectually stimulating. So that's what I've done. I can, of course, quote other people's studies. That's an easy thing to do. But I like to do it myself and then compare with other people's studies. And broadly speaking, what I'm doing is rather simplistic, but at least it gives me confidence that we're on the right lines. Because occasionally you hear things being touted in the press which are clearly nonsensical. And often people feel uncomfortable about how do I go about knowing that that's nonsensical. In many cases, with a reasonable scientific training and a reasonable ability at maths and a bit of imagination, you can work all these things out yourself.
That was Professor Martin Blunt. You can view his Shell London lecture, or any past lecture, by visiting the Geological Society's website. In the next episode, the Geological Society collaborates with the Science Council to bring all the news and views from the Big Bang Fair of Science and Engineering in Manchester.